I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hello there, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And today we have a very special show. We're going to bring a film to you on the radio. How are we going to do that? It is a very special film. In fact, it's a tantalizingly delicious documentary that follows an 85-year-old master of sushi, a sushi chef. And we have with us in the studio the author and director, David Gelb, of this film. Welcome, David.
Hi, Linda.
And his editor, Brandon Driscoll Luttringer. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. And David, this is your first film, correct?
Yes, this is my first full-length feature film.
Well, let me preface it for our listeners. This film was had its U.S. premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival last week. Very great reception and terrific honor. And you've been at the Berlin Film Festival, and you're going to Sydney as well with this?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Well, let's tell us a little bit about what I was lucky enough to be able to see the documentary. And let me tell you, the one thing I have to say is do not go hungry, because we walked out after that film ready to eat anything in sight, but particularly longing for sushi. So tell us a little bit about what this film is.
Well, basically, you know, I just love sushi very, very much. My mother, who is here with us today.
And I forgot to mention his mother and my dear friend and a foodie herself in the food world, Donna Gelb, is here.
Yeah, so my mother kind of helped cultivate this this love for sushi when I was very young. When my parents would take me to Japan on my father's business trips, my mom and I would go to the department store, and I would gorge myself on cucumber rolls when I was maybe 2 years old. And so ever since then, sushi has just been, you know, my absolute favorite food, and I can't get enough of it. My other passion is filmmaking, and so I thought, what a perfect, you know, I'd never seen a good sushi documentary before. You know, I've seen the clips on television and things like that, but nothing really kind of elevated. So I thought it would be the perfect intersection of my two favorite things, and it would be my job to eat the best sushi in the world. So that's kind of how it started.
Well, I have to say this film does not strike me as your typical documentary at all. This is really an in-depth human story as well, but at the same time, we got this fabulous-looking fish up front and central. It is just glistening and glorious, and really tells the story of what it takes to be a master sushi chef. Now, we have to say that this sushi restaurant is the only sushi restaurant to receive 3 Michelin stars, correct?
Was the first.
The first,
actually.
Okay.
And
another one has gotten it?
Yeah, the second sushi restaurant to receive 3 stars was opened by his apprentice, Mizutani,
yes.
Who's, you know, a very well-known sushi chef. And
I thought
sushi
it only got 2 stars.
Is incredible. No, he was the second chef to get 3 stars. Yeah.
So this film follows this 85-year-old master chef,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And his restaurant is this exalted palace of raw fish, and it has only 10 seats.
Mm-hmm.
This is a coveted reservation, no doubt, as the film brought out as well. How in the world did you gain entry into this restaurant? I mean, try to follow any other 3-star, you know, Michelin chef for a month or whatever you did. How did you become a fly on the wall in this place?
Well, you know, originally I wanted to make the film about many different chefs. And it just happened that Jiro, you know, he's 85 years old, and his son is
Jiro Ono. And the restaurant is
called Sukiyabashi Jiro, which is located in Ginza in Tokyo, which is kind of the where all the best, you know, top restaurants are in Tokyo.
And yet it's kind of in the basement.
It is in the basement of an office building. Kind of connected to the subway station. But actually, Jiro would never want to move. He loves this location because of the air conditioning and the air purification system. The air is the same every single day. Ah. So that's, you know, his part of his whole ethos is to keep everything as standard and by standard I mean consistent as possible.
Alters the
flavor.
Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, he senses the slightest changes and things like that.
Well, my question had been how did you manage to become a fly on the wall?
Mm-hmm.
So to speak.
Yeah. Well, this is all thanks to the food writer Masahiro Yamamoto in Tokyo, who was introduced to through a colleague of my father's, and he is an old friend of Jiro's and convinced Jiro that making a film like this about him would be a good idea. I, you know, told both Yamamoto and then later Jiro that, you know, I have no agenda. I'm a total blank slate, and all that I want to do is show the world what sushi is from your perspective, from Jiro's perspective. And I think that he, you know, he seemed okay with that. And, you know, I really just every day, you know, I would come in and I would do my best, you know, Japanese good morning, and, you know, trying my best with the language and trying to stay out of their way as much as possible. And they were just incredibly welcoming, and, you know, I would eat breakfast with them in the morning and, you know, just kind of as best as I could try to become part of the team.
Well, as you said that this was, what I wanted to mention was this film is all in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So translation was a bit of a challenge as far as getting, I mean, the conversation is sometimes very quick too. Mm-hmm. It's a film that I need to go back and see again because the first time watching it, of course, I didn't want to miss a thing. I wanted to read the subtitles and yet I went and I wanted to see what was going on. But I feel as I was reading the subtitles, maybe I missed some of the shots that I wanted to go back and look at again.
Mm-hmm.
So I really need to either put it on slow and watch it, or I just watch it again purely for the visuals, because I have to say it is shot beautifully. It is really a beautiful film to watch. And so you were saying you followed this man and you sat and had breakfast with them, and them being his son.
Right, his son Yoshikazu, who's been at the restaurant for, you know, maybe 30 years now, I think. You know, he's over 50 and started when he was 18. And so there's this great kind of, you know, father-son story because, you know, I mean, if you can only imagine being the son of an absolute living legend like Jiro. I mean, if you go to any serious sushi restaurant, they'll know who Jiro is, and there's an incredible reverence for him around the world. And his son is, you know, kind of living in his shadow in a way. You know, they still work at the restaurant together, and
kind of waiting for Dad to step aside.
Well, sort of. You know, he thought that you know, in the film, he even says, you know, I thought my father was going to retire a long time ago. But you know, Yoshikazu is an incredible chef, and you know, he actually, maybe when he was younger, he was impatient, but now he just sees every day that he can work with his father as an opportunity to learn more,
to become a master,
mm-hmm.
the master himself.
And then he also has a team of incredibly dedicated apprentices. One of which who has been there for 12 years, and you know, could absolutely be a master sushi chef in his own right. But
now, was he the young man who it took 10 years to perfect the egg sushi?
Yes, that's correct.
10 years. They wouldn't accept it until it was perfect, and it took him 10 years.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, in the West, egg sushi, tamago, it's called, is not really a very popular sushi. You know, people go to sushi restaurants and
it's
they want
like
fish.
Kind of like an extra on the side of the plate.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so sometimes it's just a garnish. You know, and people think, oh, well, I can make eggs at home. But actually, the egg sushi, you know, at a good sushi restaurant is incredibly delicious and incredibly sophisticated. And it's actually sort of the final test of the apprentice. When the apprentice is, after 10 years, he's allowed to attempt to make the eggs. And in the case of Nakazawa, our beleaguered 12-year apprentice, it took him about 200 attempts before he got it right. And then at that point, you become a full-fledged chef.
And I would have taken any of the rejects. They all look good to me.
Absolutely. I mean, the scrutiny that Jiro looks at things is far beyond what the a normal, you know, a normal nose and tongue can
sense. And this is I think, to me, it was the main thrust of the film was the perfection, the scrutiny that Jiro exerts on his everyday food, and it's not everyday food, but his everyday tasks in cooking. To think that he stands there and cuts and produces sushi day in, day out, every day. He misses it when he's not there. I mean, to me, one would think, oh my God, that would drive me crazy. But he's always striving for the next step, it seems, the next innovation, the next move. And he does innovate. He does add different things, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Jiro's he's always looking for improvement, but his routine every day is exactly the same.
Perfection.
Yeah.
It's just perfection.
Well, he's looking for perfection. But he knows that he doesn't have it, you know, and this is kind of the torment of the shokunin. And a shokunin.
Shokunin means chef?
A shokunin is a craftsman. So it applies to, you know, potters and, you know, painters. A shokunin is somebody who basically uses their hands in a craft and does the same thing every day, trying to create this kind of consistent level so that they can try to find improvement. So they're constantly, brutally, honestly evaluating their own work and looking for slight improvements over the years.
A very zen attitude.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, he of course, in order to achieve, you know, the next level of getting closer to perfection, I mean, he has to be pretty tough with the apprentices, like we mm-hmm. talked about. This comes out that he's a little bit, you know, sometimes he can be I don't know if harsh as is.
Impatient, I think.
Okay. Yeah. We were talking earlier before the show about something that he said that a chef has to have five. There are five basic attributes that a very good chef needs. And we were trying to remember all the five.
Oh,
ones,
yeah.
But one of them was what? Impatience?
Yeah, absolutely. Masahiro Yamamoto, who was this incredibly poetic, man. I've never heard of somebody speak so passionately about sushi or food at all, for that matter. And he appears in the film sort of as our narrator of sorts.
He's a restaurant critic and the food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a food writer, and you know
Tokyo,
he's a TV personality in Japan as well. And yeah, so he in his studies of food have found that all of the best chefs have maybe five characteristics in common. The first of which being a determination to always be working at the top of their game. And then they also are trying to constantly improve what they're doing. So that would be the second. The third is cleanliness, that the restaurant must be absolutely spotless. Because if the restaurant doesn't feel clean, then the food is not going to taste good. Then the fourth attribute is impatience. And, you know, they are kind of, the way Yamamoto describes it is that they work better as leaders than, you know, as followers. They can't be on the same level as the other people that work in the restaurant. They have mm-hmm. to be the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully Brandon, who has watched the movie many more times than I have, can help us out with the... Was there a fifth one? It's hard to remember on the spot.
We may have...
Is the fifth one that they're looking to constantly improve, I think?
It may be also... Maybe they were doubling down on improvement, I think. Yeah. That's possible.
Yeah.
We'll amend it on the
website.
The
fifth one is basically that they're a perfectionist, you know, and that they don't take anything than the best.
Yeah.
From any, yeah, the fifth one is basically perfection, you know, the strive for perfection, and that they basically are perfectionists in their craft. And in that sense, they've mastered it to the level of the highest level of their being a chef. And then they're constantly, you know, just trying to chisel away at creating something even better than what they consider to be perfect in their craft.
That really sums up Jiro. I mean, he really, you can see him as you followed him in his travels, and his son as well. I mean, his son is kind of just a spitting image. I mean, you can see him travel through.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Yoshikazu is very similar to his father. In fact, their sushi is almost identical, which is amazing.
When there's are we allowed to divulge the fact of?
Oh no, we should wait.
Cooking?
We should wait on that.
Okay.
But you'll have to see the film to find out all the
surprises.
Yeah, find
out the secrets.
Film.
Yes,
but,
in the film.
yeah, and you know, I was talking to Brandon about this yesterday, but after, you know, Brandon and I both went to USC together. We were randomly matched as freshman roommates by the school computer system or whatever, and we've been working together ever since. So I've always said that, you know, after we graduated from USC, we kind of went to grad school, which was just working on music videos and things like that, and then working on Jiro was sort of like our master class or something like that, because, you know, the lessons about hard work and this kind of patience and determination is really incredibly moving. And in the process of making the film, we've tried to apply that. And, you know, nobody knows this more than Brandon, who, you know, day after day is coming in and trying to refine, you know, trying to refine the structure of the film. And, you know, every day, you know, we're just throwing things away. When it doesn't work, we just have to throw it away. And
so you're feeling a little bit like Jiro, right, Brandon?
Absolutely.
We're going to talk a little bit more about, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to talk about some of the challenges that you faced in making this film. We'll be right back.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
And hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past with David Gelb and Brandon Driscoll-Luttinger, the director and editor, respectively, of Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And it's funny because when I first heard the title, I thought, okay, but... He said he really does dream of sushi, dreams of better ways he can make it and new ways he can make it, correct? I mean, is that...
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a true innovator and, like, you know, a real virtuoso. And, yeah, he describes in the film how he leaps out of bed in the middle of the night with visions of sushi and would apply ideas from his dreams into his work.
Weird. but that's okay. I mean, if it tastes good, I'll eat it. You did a wonderful scene, and Brandon, I want to bring you in on this, about the tuna auction at the Tsukiji fish market in Tokyo. That was a beautiful piece there on the fish market and the auction. I don't know if anyone's ever seen this, but I have seen different film clips of the fish market before, but the way that you presented this one was beautiful, and the auction scene of these huge tunas were incredible. The auctioneers, much like, you know, American auctioneers, they've got their sing song, they've got their call and response kind of action going, but you set it to music. You let them be the music with gorgeous music behind it. It was like an opera. Brandon, this must have been yet an extra challenge. How did you work on that?
Well, it was really interesting because they actually use bells as a precursor to the auction to get everyone's attention. Mm. So they start ringing these bells slowly and then more fast, at a fast pace, and it brings it to kind of a, you know, this level of kind of a, you know, a very intense moment. And so what we did was we found other music which would basically build slowly with this bell kind of resonating, and then build into the music with the bell and the guys with the actual bells. And, you know, the whole thing kind of builds up to the guys, you know, yelling all these all these auction.
Yeah, I mean, it achieves a frenetic pace that you know some of these livestock, fish, and flower markets usually do in the auctions. You know, they just this crazy pitch.
Right, right, yeah, and then we built into drums and things, so it would, yeah, it would, the energy would rise along with the auction. But of course, we started very slowly because, you know, there's, you know, the fish is just, and actually, you know what, in terms of history, the auction has actually not changed very much. It's, I mean, we had old stock footage that, you know, we use a little bit of in the film, and they did it exactly 50 years ago, and you can see the motions, everything is exactly the same way, except the tuna are actually a lot smaller now.
Yeah, well, that we know. We know from the fishing that's a problem. You get things getting fished out, and a lot of it coming from a lot further away than the Japanese would would realize when they're eating their sushi. And let's talk a little bit about sushi. This is a culinary history show. We do have to focus on food here, but the film is a food lover's dream as well. I mean, because the shots are absolutely gorgeous, and sushi. I mean, sushi took over in New York, especially in the, I guess, the early 80s. It sort of, you know, had this huge wave of popularity. David, what did you learn about sushi at all in Japan making this film?
Well, you know, when sushi came to the United States, it changed quite a bit. I mean, sushi originally, you know, was sold from essentially street vendors. And that came...
In Japan. Right.
And it was way back in the day, you know, the first incarnation of sushi was essentially preserved fish in rice. The flavor of the rice, you know, would seep into the fish, and they would use the rice as the rice fermented. It would kind of seal the fish in a way, and that was, you know, used as a kind of preserved snack for, you know, the army and things like that. But, you know, the flavor was actually kind of desirable, this idea of, you know, and then that kind of evolved into a street food in Tokyo in the 1800s. When it came to the United States, we started seeing things like the California roll and integrating, you know, American food products like avocado, right. And kind of to fill the American appetite. But back in Japan, you know, it was a very, you know, restaurants like Kyobashi Yoshino, which was one of the first, you know, great sushi restaurants, kind of that's the way that we see sashimi today, kind of came from that restaurant, you know, sashimi and various sushi appetizers and a lot of the preparations of the fish, because, you know, it's not just fish and rice. And that's one of the biggest misconceptions about sushi, is that you can't just put fish on top of rice and really call it sushi. The fish, in order to bring it to its point of ideal deliciousness, you know, requires a certain degree of aging, storing it at a certain temperature, in addition to just selecting, you know, fish that have good flavor, that fish that have been swimming in the channels, that where they're eating delicious food and can build, you know, a good kind of fat structure and molecular structure that's going to be, you know, tasty, that's going to have good flavor. Jiro was the first sushi chef to serve only sushi.
No sashimi, other appetizers, nothing, just
and
sushi.
This is a departure, you know, and he worked at Kyobashi Yoshino, and a lot of the other greatest sushi chefs also worked with him, or contemporaries at Kyobashi Yoshino. And when Jiro left, you know, it took him a while to get to the point where he could really focus only on sushi. But all that he wants to do is just to make sushi pieces, and that's all that he cares about. He has no interest in sashimi anymore. He has no interest in any kind of appetizers. You're allowed to order alcohol in the restaurant, but he won't recommend it because he doesn't want it to
alter the taste,
your senses, or to alter the exactly. Yeah. So, you know, Jiro kind of created the modern omakase in this way, which is the chef's course that is only sushi. And there are some great sushi chefs in the United States who kind of are continuing this tradition. So, like Nozawa at Sushi Nozawa in Studio City is a chef who, his whole motto is "Trust me," and you sit at the bar and he gives you maybe, you know, 20 pieces of sushi, and you know, and that's it.
In fact, some people even interpret omakase to mean "trust me."
Exactly, and that's absolutely correct.
Trust the chef. Yeah. Well, you know, you were talking about the choosing the fish that, you know, have had a good diet, that have swum in clean waters. And that's something I wanted to mention about the fish market that we didn't talk about. And that was the way that those who are going to procure the fish for the day choose their fish. They use two items to choose their fish, a flashlight and their fingers. I thought that was so amazing. Can you explain a little bit about that and what you observed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the kind of the this is actually one of the great things about Japanese culture is the is this kind of devotion to specialization. So every ingredient that Jiro uses is created or, you know, procured by the by an absolute master in that field. So the rice is he gets the rice from the
special grower.
From the rice expert, and the tuna comes from a guy who specializes only in tuna, and the shrimp from a guy who specializes only in shrimp.
And perfection, so, once again.
Yeah, and so they spend, you know, just as much time as Jiro's apprentices do, you know, working on sushi. These fish dealers are masters of their fish. So, you know, Jiro gets his fish from the world's best tuna dealer, whose name is Fujita, and who's fairly famous in Japan. And he is the most discriminating tuna buyer. And, you know, through vast experience, you know, having worked for his father before him, he can basically just take a little bit of tuna out of, you know, a little bit of meat out of the tail of a tuna. You know, they lay out the tunas and they cut the tails off so you can examine a little bit of the tail. Mm-hmm. And he can intuit
just by rubbing it in his fingers,
smelling it, tasting it a little bit, shining it with the flashlight, he can tell what the entire interior of the fish is going to look like, and he knows how that fish is going to age and mature over the next few days.
So I don't know who the first one to do this is, but now, as I observed in the film, everyone was doing. You know, all the buyers were picking up on that idea. You know, you shine a light on it and feel it.
Oh, absolutely, and that's standard. But what the talent comes in being able to identify what is good from this little morsel. Is this a good fish or is it not a good fish? And, you know, Fujita just has the most impeccable taste, and Jiro refuses to buy tuna from anyone else. He doesn't trust anybody else. It's just Fujita.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I want to mention, so we don't run out of time, is talk about the music. The music throughout the film. I mean, I could not imagine more perfect music. That was. Tell me about what you picked and why.
Well, we chose we needed the music to be elevated, sort of like the sushi,
like the art,
exactly. Yes, yeah. And you know, this was a consideration in all of the, you know, in the cinematography as well. But yes, we chose orchestral pieces played by masters, you know, and performed by masters and composed by masters, like we have Tchaikovsky, Mozart, and Bach. And we also have recordings from Philip Glass and Max Richter.
I thought Glass and Richter, those two in particular, when you were doing a lot of the food preparation shots, were perfect. And you mentioned why you chose those.
Oh, yeah. Well, thematically, they kind of mirror Jiro's work ethic. And Philip Glass music is sort of is beautiful yet repetitive. But always elevating and always reaching for the next level, sort of, and building upon itself. And this is kind of Jiro's sort of his whole kind of philosophy is to do the same thing every day and just kind of looking for layers of improvement. And the other reason the music works well is because of, you know, Brandon, who has edited maybe at least 100 music videos, many of which, you know, have millions of hits on
well,
the YouTube.
Brandon, it certainly came across. I mean, it's just matched perfectly and brilliantly. What to you was the greatest challenge in editing this film? I mean, it must have been. I mean, a month you followed him, right? Or then some, a couple different times. You were in Japan. David was in Japan filming for a month or more. You must have had hundreds and hundreds of yards of footage that hit the floor, so they say, you know, in the old days.
I've had hundreds of yards before this film, and with this film, the biggest challenge was editing a film where I couldn't understand a word they were saying. It was all subtitled, so it was all in Japanese. However, I actually found that was a benefit later on when we were using classical music and having the Japanese words with subtitles with this beautiful music. It was very poetic to listen to because it almost the Japanese language and the classical music works so well together. And I feel like if it had been like narrated by an American or something in English, you would have been hearing the voice and hearing the classical music, and it wouldn't have hit a note, you know, that resonated with you nearly as much. So when you're reading, and I really enjoy reading to classical music. When you're reading the subtitles and hearing the voices, it all really comes together in a really great way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. It turned out to be a benefit in terms of how the movie comes across and in the way it sounds. But it was very difficult for me to sit there and read a movie every single time. I watched it all day, every day, reading, yeah, instead of just hearing. So yeah, that was the biggest challenge for me.
Well, you did include some historical footage, from Jiro's life, from his past life. So you got a few shots in there. That's what I was going to say. That's where the story takes a very human turn, and didn't want to spend too much time talking about that, but that is a compelling feature of this film. Not just the food, I must say. It is indeed the human element. There are two sons. We didn't mention the first son. First son can never be heir to, I mean, the second son can never be heir to the restaurant, so he has his own restaurant, but the first son has to wait until the father steps aside. And this, you know, and the father had a rough life. I mean, this is all just a wonderful father-son kind of relationship that you brought up. I think that people come away with a lot from this film. And did you go in doing to capture this human condition, or is it all about food first?
Yeah, you know, the very, very first incarnation of it was about, it was about food, and the human element was just going to be kind of this pursuit of perfection. When we chose to go with, to make the film just about Jiro, I knew that something about his son, there was going to be some kind of drama with his son. And I wasn't sure exactly what it was. And it's a very difficult kind of pitch for a movie. You know, I went out, for 1 month in February of 2010, shot everything that I could, really everything that I could. And mm-hmm. then we came back and had everything subtitled. And then Brandon and I started building the story. And, we found that Jiro's son was kind of becoming a main character, in a way that we hadn't expected. And so we were really pleased that this human element was kind of ringing true and kind of forging the narrative using this kind of father-son story. And so, you know, I'm so happy that it came out like that, because actually, you know, people have been coming up to us and saying, I don't like sushi, but I like this movie.
Why should I watch the movie?
Yeah, but they say that they say that they like the movie even though they don't like sushi.
Right.
And they want to try sushi. And I think that's, you know, just the absolute greatest compliment. It's been so humbling that, you know, and I'm so thankful for Brandon for really being able to bring this, you know, helping to bring this story to the forefront of the film.
Well, and the two of you did just an excellent job. Before we leave, I want to, I want to urge people to see this. You were very fortunate. You've got Magnolia Films have bought it for distribution here, and Fortissimo internationally.
Yeah. We have Magnolia Pictures is going rolling the film out into movie theaters across the United States, which is incredibly exciting. I mean, it's what we had dreamed of when we first started, was having a theatrical release in the United States. And then also abroad, Fortissimo Films is going to be, you know, we have deals across Europe and in Asia, and I'm just thrilled that people are going to be able to see sushi from Jiro's perspective around the world.
Yeah,
and
you should both feel very proud too, because it is a beautiful film and an excellent job and a testimony to Jiro, because it is like sushi, it's striving for perfection, and you did an absolutely wonderful job. I want to leave with something that IndieWire wrote about the film, and that is, Jiro Dreams of Sushi is a mouth-watering love letter to sushi and a moving testament to the beauty of family, tradition, and the pursuit of perfection in one's work. And that pretty much wraps it up. That's what it is. I want to thank again David Gelb and Brandon Driscoll-Luttringer.
Thank you.
Get that right one of these days. And thanks to Donna Gelb, his mom, for being with us too. This has been Linda Palacio on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaway's Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the Green Market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.